the podcast where knowledge meets curiosity. Join Professor Margaret Vaughn as she explores groundbreaking ideas with top scholars aimed at sharpening our thinking. With her guests, Dr. Vaughn dives into a world of profound insights and intellectual adventure. Our journey to getting smarter starts here.
Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning. Well, welcome, listeners. Today, we get to talk to one of my most favorite people in this work. Her name is Dr. Susan B. Newman, and she is a specialist in early literacy development whose research and teaching interests include early childhood policy, curriculum, and early reading instruction for children who live in poverty. Dr. Newman has written more than 100 articles and has authored and edited several books. Dr. Newman received her doctorate at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, California, her MA at California State University, Hayward. In her role as the U.S. Secretary for Elementary and Secondary Education, Dr. Newman established the Early Reading First Program, developed the Early Childhood Educator Professional Development Program, and was responsible for all activities in Title I of the Elementary and Secondary Act. Wow. And it goes on. She has been co-editor of the Journal of Literacy Research, and serves on several editorial boards, including Reading Research Quarterly, Reading Teacher, and the Journal of Literacy Research. Dr. Newman has directed or been actively involved with numerous early literacy research organizations and state and national projects. She's received many, many, many awards and honors for her amazing research and public service, including the Literacy Research Association's Oscar Causey Award, and is a member of the Reading Hall of Fame, and is one of my favorite people of all time. Welcome, Dr. Newman. Thank you so much for coming and visiting today. How are you?
Good.
Oh, it's delightful to see you. And thanks for making this time. I know you're so busy, and thank you for making the time to talk with me today.
I'm delighted. It's fun.
Yeah. Well, so I wanted to get started and welcome again. So before we get started and talking a little bit more, I was always wondering, why did you go into the field of education and teaching? How did that come about? What was that?
Well, you know, I'm reading this great book now called The Women's Hour, and it reminded me, it's a study of women's suffrage, and the fact that women were it's hard to believe that women weren't allowed to vote in this country. And similarly, when I got started, there weren't many careers that women could actually go into. My brothers were all lawyers. My father was also a lawyer, but I wasn't allowed to be a lawyer because I was a woman. So there were two professions. One was nursing and one was teaching. And I didn't like blood, so I went into teaching. It was really as strategic as that.
That's wonderful. Wow. So I'm trying to think a little bit more. I mean, your career is so expansive and so incredible. I mean, maybe talk a little bit about how you went from a classroom teacher, and tell us what grades you taught and how that transformed into this amazing, amazing career that, you know, I every time I pick up a new journal, I see your amazing work that you're doing all across the country. So maybe talk a little bit about your history and maybe from the classroom and how it kind of progressed.
So I started teaching, you know, like many teachers, this will happen too, unfortunately, but I ended up teaching in a place that was very high poverty. And generally what they would do in this particular district is they would take the newest teachers and they would put them in the poorest schools. And what I mean by poor schools, it was poor in terms of the region, and it was poor in terms of children actually coming to school, very often very, very needy. I was a new teacher. I was trying my best, and I learned to love the children and wanted to do the best for them. I invited them over to my house. I made dinner for them. I did all these
Wow.
sort of things, but I realized I didn't teach them very well. I was emotionally connected, but I wasn't able to move their trajectory in their education very far. Many of the kids, they were fifth graders. They were functioning at the second grade level, and I was heartbroken about that, but I really didn't know what to do. So I went back to school, and I went to a teacher institution where it was very concrete, and I learned about methods of teaching reading. And I think that's where I really became more of a specialist. I learned what it would take in order to really improve children's reading skills. And I then went back to teaching just reading in a Title I kind of situation. And many years ago, Title I was a pullout program. In other words, we would take struggling readers and we'd pull them out for about half an hour and then give them a short bit of instruction, and then they would go back into the classroom. Well, that wasn't very effective. It was not a very effective mechanism for helping these kids to learn how to read. So I was again frustrated. And so I went back to school, and that's when I got my PhD. I decided I really needed to know more about reading, about how the school infrastructure might work so that we could provide a better surround for so many students who lived in poverty. So that's how I got my beginning. And then I decided that I wanted to go into higher education because I thought I could affect more people. Here I would work with not just one teacher, but many, many teachers, and I could help them in the very beginning of their preparation program. And I found that that was more or less my calling, that it was something I really loved to do. I loved to work with teachers who were new to the profession, still excited about getting into the classroom. And I pretty much have done that ever since.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, you know, if you even the biography I read in the beginning, you know, and you're all the work that you've done. I mean, the way that you are, you know, you've impacted teacher preparation and also policy. Like, I find that so fascinating. And I'm kind of tongue-tied because it's just so impressive the way that you have so many platforms that you're able to navigate. You know, you do teacher preparation, you work on the ground in schools, and you do these amazing projects across cities, like the book project in Philadelphia, and that's just one of many. The laundrette work, that, you know, just all of these really innovative ways to kind of get reading and literacy at the forefront of people and communities' minds. But how did that come about? I mean, how did the role as the assistant secretary come about, and how did you make these jumps? I guess I'm kind of wondering
I think one of the things that you could say to potential educators is that a lot of what happens to people in their lives is serendipity. It just happens. You don't really plan for anything. It just, one thing kind of leads to another. And in the situation, from going from teacher preparation, I found myself wanting to move towards city. There's something very powerful for me in the city, the diversity of people, the diversity of thinking, the numbers of people that are surrounding you. And so I went to Temple University as one of my second or third jobs in higher education. And I was struck, and it's happening all across the country now, I was struck with Philadelphia as a wonderful city, but as a city that was almost bankrupt. It had no money. And as a result, what you would have happen is you would see a lot of homelessness. You would see a lot of desperation in that city. It was an amazing city. But at the same time, there was a second city, a city of desperation that I would often see. And so one of the first things I did when I was at Temple University is I would walk to a school, the closest school to my university. And I would see the blight, and I would see what children would have to go through in order to go to school, and how dangerous it was in that environment. And I began to say, how could children really concentrate on reading and writing when they're surrounded by this hopelessness and this degree of dysfunctionality in the city? In other words, some of the children, they would look at a trash truck and they wouldn't know what it was because they had never seen a trash truck in their neighborhood because it never came. They never received any Wow. police services. They never had a bus come on time. And as a result, I began to understand that the environment has tremendous impact on children's literacy development and children's education development largely. And I became fascinated with not only the school as a context for learning, but as a community and neighborhood as a context for learning. And these things are more or less threaded throughout my entire career, that people live not in just their homes, but they live in a neighborhood and a community, and that all affects their learning, the children's learning. And so what I did is I began to document that work, and I began to document inequality. And it was so painful to me that I went to the Philadelphia Inquirer. It sounds crazy at this time. And I went to a reporter who reported on the city, and I said, I want to show you the tale of two cities. I want to show you how the school district is providing unequal opportunity for children. And she said, well, and that's a very interesting story, but I kind of don't buy it. You know, I've been reporting on this city for many, many years. So I happened to go to a conference. It's now called LRA, but it was called the National Reading Conference. And I gave this paper of how frustrated I was about the inequality in this city. And at the same time, I got a note through the initial internet saying that my story was on the first page of the Philadelphia Inquirer, that the story of inequality was first page, and she documented the things that I had documented. It actually went back to the places in that study to show Wow. how unequal things were. And it caused a good deal of attention to that issue. And as a result, funders came and they wanted to fund me for helping to do something about inequality. And we worked in childcare centers, we worked in libraries all across the city to try and provide more opportunities for them. And at the same time, what happened was George W. Bush in Texas heard about this work. He was a new governor. He was trying to provide some new initiatives in reading. His wife was a librarian, so she was very interested in, let me have some water. Yeah. She was very interested in reading, so they invited me to Texas. Oh. And I gave a talk, and it turned out that the talk was to the legislature. I never knew that. And they then invited me for lunch. And I got to be a regular in Texas.
Wow.
And so then when George W. Bush became president, Reed Lyon called me and said, he wants you to come to Washington. And that was how it all came about.
What was that like to get that call?
Well, Washington is a very different environment. They call it a town of 1,000 knives. That's true. And it was wonderful. I mean, it was a wonderful experience. The very first day he was in office, I went to the Roosevelt Room. I went to the
Wow.
West Wing, and he talked about phonological awareness. I thought I was in heaven. He gave me a glass of water with a napkin of the White House label. I went to the bathroom. I put in my bra. I could take it home. I was thrilled. But then the reality of Washington becomes very clear, and it was a very sharp reality. Bush, who was a socially liberal president initially, became increasingly conservative after 9/11. And the word was, frankly, that Cheney had a good deal to do with that. And so he went from really having a bullet, a target on early literacy and literacy, to really focusing on Iran and the 9/11 issue. So we were no longer in the mix of what was essential, and a lot of things started happening which took a more and more conservative bent. And that hurt me, because I remember, here's an anecdote, but this is perfect for Washington. I was giving the same talk that I had given at NRC about inequality, and then I was told quietly after I gave this talk, and it happened to be in one of the states, I was told that there is no inequality, that the administration doesn't believe that there's inequality, and so therefore you're not allowed to talk about inequality. So all of a sudden you realize that you have a boss. You have a boss. And it may be Rod Paige, who's the education secretary, but it's really George W. Bush that you work for. And an academic doesn't
Have a
like
boss.
bosses. We're not used to bosses. And so when I returned from Washington, I felt like I would kiss the ground. I felt like I had my own voice again, that I was once able to talk about what I believed was important, what I held true. And I've felt that ever since.
Oh boy, I mean, I find that just so fascinating, and how you're able to like work across all those spaces and just have such eloquence about the experience, but also just what it means for. So when you went back into, doing work in communities, did it charge you up even more in terms of having that experience in Washington? Was it just
Yes.
like, okay, that's it. I'm, even more.
Well, I went back, and I no longer taught at Temple University. I went back to University of Michigan, and that was another wonderful experience. The University of Michigan, of course, is a fabulous university, but I was able to get quite large grants, which gave me an opportunity to really focus now on school literacy and early literacy in the schools. And so we developed as a team a vocabulary and comprehension program, and we were able to study it in depth and in many different places in Michigan, about 50 different school districts. And so that was thrilling in its own right. I began to feel like maybe the impact is local more than national. Maybe national, you can have some impact, but gosh, the feeling of local impact is so much more impactful on the individual. And so I found that absolutely thrilling, to work with young teachers, work with children, and actually see their growth trajectory so dramatic when you provide high quality instruction. So it was both great to be at the national level, but also great to be at the very local level.
I love that. And the effectiveness of scaling up a vocabulary intervention for low-income children, right, pre-K through first grade in the elementary school journal. And I love that. That's the work. And I love the way that you were, you know, you had such a direct impact on kids and communities.
Right.
What was the lessons you felt like you learned from that in terms of just kind of as a researcher? Were there any, you know, you could share with maybe some, you know, beginning doctoral students or different researchers in the field? Like, I find your work fascinating, like the way you structure your designs and how you, you know, you have such an impact in such different ways. But any, we've talked before about this, but I wonder if you have any insights about that.
Well, one of the things that happened at University of Michigan is because when you get a large grant, you can get a large number of people working together. And it really helps nowadays, especially, I think, to have research teams. I found that I was able to have postdocs and doctoral students and master students and undergraduate students, and getting that mix and getting that from very different disciplines. Like, we had sociologists working with us and you know, statistical gurus, and we had also, though, people in psychology. So in other words, really bringing together many, many different disciplines. It was terrific. And it was also fun, lots of fun.
Yeah.
you could brainstorm and think more broadly. You know, many times when we do a research project, we sort of do one project. But what we were able to do is create a tree and a whole organization based on vocabulary and comprehension. We focused on educative materials, and we focused on curriculum and teacher preparation and all levels of the infrastructure, on groupness. And that was really exciting to be broad and yet deep at the same time.
Oh, I love that. Oh, I love that. And in another piece that, you know, I find so interesting just from a research design perspective is your project, the Getting Books in Children's Hands, Creating a Citywide Book Distribution Policy Using a Mixed Methods Geospatial Approach. And that's just one of my favorite pieces. That's in the American Educational Research Journal. Will you maybe share a little insight or anything about that project that you learned or you found fascinating, or just any aspect of it? I'd love to learn from you about that.
Well, thank you. One of the strands that I've been interested in all my career is really about access to literacy and the fact that there are many book deserts in our country where children lack access to print. And so, as I mentioned, I had established a long-term relationship with the William Penn Foundation, and they came to me and they said, we are interested in really creating, ensuring that children are successful readers by the end of grade three, part of the campaign for grade level reading. And one of those aspects in order to meet those goals would be to provide book access to children. And so we did what we call a geospatial analysis, where we analyzed where were the books going that were being given to children all across the city. And one of the things that we realized is there are many, many organizations, do-good organizations, that are not connected to one another. And Margaret, I think this is a big issue, because I think a lot of organizations are giving out books or doing something nice, but aren't aware of what other organizations are doing. And as a result, we actually end up duplicating a lot of activities.
Yeah.
And we also, in duplicating activities, we waste a lot of resources in many cases. So we began to realize that these geospatial analysis, through an analysis of where the distributions were going, there were over 70 organizations in this one city alone
Wow.
that were providing books to children. And And sometimes the books were the same titles. So in other words, they get frozen from the dentist, then they go to the doctor, and they get frozen from the
Right.
doctor. And that is not motivating to parents at all. In other words, you might just sort of toss a book at that point. So we began to say that these good-hearted methods, these good-hearted organizations need to collaborate more than they are currently. And they need to recognize that some of the do-good process might actually have a negative effect on families. So, for example, if I give you a book, someone actually just did this for me. They gave me a book, and I thought, oh, that's so nice. But the fact of the matter is, I hate the book. Don't tell her. I hate it. And so she writes me and she said, well, let's talk about the book. So I think, oh
Oh,
gosh, no,
no.
I have to read the book. I hate the book and I have to read it. Well, I'm a good soul and so I can read a lot, read pretty fast, and so therefore I'll read it. But do you notice that there's a lot of negative strings attached to giving books away to someone, that it may have some negative effects on those families? They may feel pressure. They may feel like, hey, are you telling me I'm not doing a good job? There's lots of subtle things that go into giving a gift. And I think what I was trying to do in that article is, number one, say that equal distribution doesn't eat equal equality. Lots of times we say that we're going to give everybody something. And what happens is you're just unleveling the playing field even more. But secondly, I think we have to realize that sometimes when we try to do good, we don't interact well with the people that we're trying to do good for. And as a result, they may want something very different than what we're providing. And we may have a certain mindset that is very different than theirs. And as a result, I think we have to be cognizant that we are different and that we need to understand their point of view. And if we don't, then we need someone else to explain their point of view, because otherwise, it's like two different worlds.
Wow, that's so fascinating. So, about that project, was there aspects of it that also surprised you in terms of the findings, or also was there a bit of a light bulb when you thought, why are we not necessarily using geospatial approaches in all of our work? I mean, was there any kind of mini light bulbs that kind of went off for you about any of that, those aspects?
Well, the light bulb, there are a couple of light bulbs, and that is, number one, cities have got to work more collaboratively, organizations. In New York here, we're trying to even figure out what are the organizations that are working together, not together, but working in the same district, that are providing sometimes conflicting messages. Providing professional development one way and providing professional development another in the same district. And so one of the things the light bulb said is, we've got to collaborate better than we have before. That's one. Number two, I think we've really got to get parent voices more clearly in what we're doing, that we haven't been listening. We've been telling, we've been doing, but we haven't been listening carefully. And we've got to. And we've got to bring, from a research perspective, we've got to bring together more innovative research models that really begin to tap multiple methods. So in that particular study, we used geospatial analysis, we used surveys, but we also did focus groups to understand parents better. So all of those things have to come together. And I think traditionally it's been hard to do mixed methods because they don't easily come together. And that will be the trick that researchers need to do.
I love that. How about any, has anything surprised you about your work? I mean, that's a huge, I mean, you have done such amazing, so many amazing things, but has there been surprises that you
Well, I
maybe
think
didn't anticipate?
our more recent surprises is really saying that what we've been doing recently is trying to understand neighborhood, as I mentioned, and we in very poor neighborhoods, a lot of the normal services that you would expect, the bodega, where to get on newspaper, where to get a cup of coffee are missing because the stores are closed. They're closed for certain hours. There's a lot of negative messaging. No loitering. No, don't go here. Don't do this. And as a result, what happens in poor neighborhoods is they often use existing institutions that they become the fulcrum of information in a community. So we've been working in laundromats, which may sound strange, but the fact of the matter is people in poor areas use the laundromat sometimes 2, 3 hours per week. And they're often areas where people come together and they chit chat, they gossip together, and they become what we call organizational brokers. It's a resource broker area where people talk to one another informally. And this is true of hair salons, barber shops. We've examined supermarkets, playgrounds, and we've begun to look at areas in the neighborhood where people can congregate and find out information. And so our work has gone to the laundromat, and we've studied how parents interact with their children, how children interact with other children, and how that becomes a literacy opportunity for these kids. And then more recently, we've looked at what we call trusted messengers. And in Philadelphia, in particular, which is the city I love, they've created block captains. These are volunteers in neighborhoods that are sort of the word that comes to mind, mensch. They're mensches, they're leaders. And they are informal leaders. They're people in the community that other people go to, they trust. And so we've been examining the impact of trusted messengers in communities and how these people who are similar in social status, similar in race and ethnicity, how they communicate important messages to people in the community about children, about literacy, in ways that you and I could never do.
Yeah.
And so this topic has really galvanized me and excited me.
Yeah, I love that.
And now in New York, we're creating what we call reading hubs, where they're either artist studios or they're places where people can go dance and creating hybrid spaces for literacy activity.
That's
I
exciting.
know it's goofy.
I love that. No, I love that. And I come from a, I went to school in Philadelphia. I went to Penn, and I did urban studies. So to me, these topics are so connected, and they sound, it just feels so connected to the time I had in my own time in Philadelphia. And one of the things I found interesting is communities can be, the insider outsider, We're always outsiders, I think, when we're not from that community. And how did you penetrate that? How did you even find out who were the community leaders in the community space? Like, how was that? How did that process happen?
You sort of have to do almost like a snowball effect. So in Philadelphia, for example, what we began to do is work with the William Penn Foundation, work with Read by Fourth, which is the campaign for grade level reading. And then they're connected to Global Citizens. And we learned that the Global Citizens Organization is responsible for the MLK Day. And the MLK Day is a day of volunteerism in community. Aha. So then we said, all right, there are community-based people and global citizens. Can you help us find community-based people in these neighborhoods or they might want to just go to the laundromat or the hair salon and read to children or talk to children informally. And so Global Citizens essentially put out a call, and a lot of senior citizens, Margaret, want to do good. Yeah. You know, they are from the community. They've gone to the same schools. They go to the same church as people in the community. They care about it. And so we gave them a t-shirt, a special t-shirt. That's all they got. No money. And they go into the laundromat and they talk to families about kindergarten registration and how to get their kids a good teacher in school. And then they read to the children, and it all was based on snowball effect.
Yeah. And relationships. Right?
We're working with the Dominican Writers Association. I don't know how we got.
Wow. And yeah. Was that another pathway to community?
It was another pathway. So they were the ones who found the artist studio and the dance studio, and they're helping us put in. It's a very Dominican area, and they're putting in culturally sensitive, linguistically sensitive volunteers in the neighborhood to really provide trusted messengers.
I'm a huge fan, so I'm trying to not like really fan out, but like you have to be so immensely proud of this work. I mean, I find it to be, you know, I can see you're beaming and you're smiling, and I feel it's so exciting, that level of relationship, the level of connectedness, the way that you're impacting local communities. It has to be so rewarding.
It is. And I love the diversity of voices. It makes me feel alive, you know? Yeah, I'm sure you feel the same way.
Yeah, you are just, I could talk to you forever. So I'm going to try to really honor your time. But I particularly find that the way that you're mapping communities and the way that it's so inspiring as a researcher to look at that. And I love that you talked about how we need to be innovative in our thinking, because, you know, I think so many of us really want to do good work in schools and communities. And I think sometimes there is a little bit of a rub on the how-to, like, how do we actually do that? And how do we, you know, how do we become more hands-on in communities? And I love it. You're like, it's relationship building, it's talking, it's being innovative in our thinking. And I think, you know, I find the work that you're doing with like in laundromats and all of these places, that I find that so inspiring. You know, it's very cool.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, it was interesting. I gave a talk to some people at the school district here in New York, and they said, how can we get parents to read to their children? And this is, as you know, Margaret, this is a perpetual question. How do we get parents to do this? Whether it's letter knowledge, whether it's reading to children, how do we do that? And I began to think a long time ago, if someone said to me, I want you to do this, you know what? My independent streak would say, are you kidding? I'm going to do what I want to do, right? So give me a break. So I'm not into changing parents. I think that's the model that we have tried to push for a long, long time. How do we get parents to? Instead, what we started to do, and I encourage nascent researchers to think about, is to go to those neighborhoods and just walk the neighborhood, try to understand what it's like, and what are some natural activities that parents are already doing with their children that can support literacy and learning. Many of them are taking them grocery shopping. Many of them are taking them to the nail salon because they have no babysitter. How can that be an environment that sparks language and literacy activities? So I began to think from a parent's point of view, what do they do? Not from a deficit approach, but an asset. based approach. These parents are doing something that is good for their children. How can I support that in ways that really promote my goals, which is to enhance their literacy development as well as their goals? And I think it's a different way of thinking. And I think it also helps us to get less frustrated. We could say to parents, read to your children till kingdom come, and some people won't. They won't for various reasons. So we need to find alternative pathways to really ensure that our kids are growing and thriving the way we all want them to.
Oh, I love that. So let's see, if you could give, you know, given your, any suggestions and insights in terms of given your career for striving to transform thinking, how about what's your current view or current advice to the field? There's a bit of a debate on, you know, different aspects of what's happening in schools. Any advice, or how could we get smarter?
Well, I think I really think we need to get smarter. One of the things I remember when No Child Left Behind was passed, and again, I was very naive. I thought life was going to change. I thought finally we were going to move to a science of reading, that we were really going to take the bulk of what we know about research and apply it carefully in the schools. And as a result, we would really achieve the equity that we've all wished for so long. And of course, I was terribly wrong, and it didn't happen. And in fact, in this city where I live now, as well as Philadelphia, what we've seen is a variation of an approach that is not anchored in strong research. And it's everywhere. And as a result, children have really suffered from not having high quality instruction, in my view. And so what did we do wrong? What did we do wrong, so wrong, that even though we knew, we still did something else? And I think that what we didn't recognize is the brilliance of our teachers, frankly. I think that even now, when we talk about the science of reading, we know the skills that children need in order to be successful in reading, but we don't really know very much about the science of teaching reading, of how to do it and do it in a way that is really effective for all students. And so I think we need to be a little bit humble. And I think that some of the current discourse is very troubling to me, because number one, it sort of positions people as saying, we know. No, we don't. We really don't. Right. We have a lot to learn. And we can learn as a community. There's no way that I'm going to begin to tell teachers what to do. I want to work with teachers, and I want to construct an understanding of what good instruction is based on their knowledge of the children, of the context, of the classroom, and as well as my knowledge of the research. I think it's a collaborative process. And initially what we did is we with Reading First, we did not recognize parents or community. Parents or community were shut out completely. I think right now we're at risk of shutting out teachers and teacher voices. Mm-hmm. And I think that will lead to a lot of problematic instruction, because over time, what teachers are going to say is, we do know things, and being told exactly what to do, it is going to have a boomerang effect on instruction. So I think learning to be a little bit humble, to recognize that science is not settled, that we have a lot to learn, that we need to embrace the entire community, that this means not only educators in the classroom, but educators in the field, whether they're librarians or some of our wonderful nonprofit organizations. I think we need to, this, we're at a very critical period right now. If we don't do it right, I worry.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. Well, any other suggestions or anything? You're just wonderful. And I love your work, and I just love reading, and I love anything. I think we can all just get so much smarter by listening to you and the work that you do. I find it so impactful for communities, and it's so innovative in how to reach communities and schools and parents and families. And thank you.
Let's go.
It is. Well, thank you so much.
This was fun.
Oh, you're just a delight.
Good luck.
Thank you.
I think this is exciting.